This is episode 419 of the Autoblog Podcast. I'm joined this week by Sam Abelsonide of Navigant Research and Juan Barnett, known as DC Car Geek on Twitter. We talk about automotive policy and the future of autonomous cars. That's all ahead on episode 419 of the Autoblog Podcast. Hello, welcome to the Autoblog Podcast. I'm Dan Roth. I'm joined this week by two non-Autoblog guests. We've got Sam Abelsonide, who is a longtime co-host of the podcast until he left for Greener Pastures at Navigant Research.
Hey, Dan, how are you tonight?
Surviving.
and we've got enough snow there yet?
I had the snowblower on the deck last weekend to get the 6-foot drift away from the sliding door. It was awesome. I'm going to have to go around the house soon the next time it warms up so that it doesn't wind up in my basement. So it's a good time out here.
Yeah,
and, you know, suffering through the cold, too, is we got Juan Barnett, who is Twitter's infamous DC car geek down in Washington, D.C. So what's going on, Juan?
Not much. Glad to be back, Dan. Glad I was invited back.
Yeah, we're going to have a rollicking good time talking about policy and autonomous cars, which may not sound interesting, but the last time we talked about it, it was interesting, and it's going to be interesting again, I promise. So anyway, let's start with the garage, because at least a couple of us get to drive press cars. So I'm sorry, Juan. I think you've got a caravan?
I do, a Grand Caravan. Grand Caravan. Emphasis on the Grand.
Yeah.
Remember when they weren't so grand. That's how old I am.
The grands were the big ones. Those were the long wheelbase. Short wheelbase ones that were the non-grands. And then they went all grand. And there's a new one coming. Did you see the spy shots?
Well, no caravan, just the town and country.
Yeah, right. But the spy shots had Dodge badging.
Yeah, well, that doesn't mean squat. They've already said they're dropping the Dodge branded vans. There's only going to be Chrysler vans going forward.
Yeah, but I expect the caravan name won't die. We'll see that on something.
Well, maybe on like the the Ram cargo van version.
No, we'll see it on a CUV once Dodge realizes that they can't get by with just performance cars.
Yeah, doesn't
Fiat what more Chrysler, could you possibly need?
Well, I mean, Fiat Chrysler has what? They've got Maserati and Ferrari. I feel like they've got and Alfa. They've got kind of specific performance brands covered.
Yeah. Without that, what else are you going to do with Dodge?
I don't know. I mean, we'll see. Dodge has a couple of solid products.
See, this is why we need autonomous vehicles. 2 minutes in, we've already run this completely off the rails.
This is a non-autonomous podcast. All right, so we were talking about what we're driving, Sam, and I'll let you go first because you've got an enormous vehicle in your garage. It probably won't even fit in your garage.
It will not fit in my garage, in fact. Nice. It's the 2015 Ford Expedition EL King Ranch. For 15, the Expedition's got a mild front and rear refresh, some updates in the interior, and they dropped the old 5.4 liter V8 finally. I think the Expedition may have been the last vehicle still using that engine.
Well, that's an engine that was engineered back in the Jurassic period, so that's fine.
Yeah, pretty much. As was most of the rest of this vehicle. actually, it's surprisingly sophisticated. Expeditions now use the 3.5 liter EcoBoost V6 as the exclusive engine, which gives it more power and more torque than that old V8, more towing capability. It's, I think depending on the configuration, you can get up to 9,200 pounds of towing capability. And believe it or not, the Expedition has actually got independent rear suspension long before Mustangs did. I mean, they've had it since this current generation debuted, I think, in 2006, which was right around the time, just after the last generation Mustang arrived. So, it's got multi-link rear suspension, which is actually really good in a vehicle like this, because have you ever tried to sit in the third row of a Suburban or a Tahoe?
Yeah, it helps if you don't have legs.
I mean, for you, it's fine, Dan.
But, right, for me, I'm good.
I don't know what you look like, Juan, but, if your legs are more than, a couple of feet long, then you're not going to be very comfortable in the back row of a Suburban or Tahoe, because you know, they have the floor pan curving up so they have clearance for the rear axle to move up and down.
See, and being in DC, I'm sure Juan knows all about Suburbans and Tahoes.
Yeah, GSA plated versions. Yeah,
absolutely. But in the third row of the Expedition, particularly the EL version, three adults can actually sit across there quite comfortably, you know, and sit upright in a normal seating position. You know, there's plenty of headroom, plenty of leg room, and you know, you're not sitting with your knees, you know, straddling your ears.
Yeah. So the things that I liked about that, because I just like a week and a half ago had the shorter Expedition, and I recently had the Navigator too, and I really liked the Navigator because it had that deluxe Navigator interior. Mm-hmm. The Expedition interior felt old and crappy. The EcoBoost powertrain's awesome. I will agree with you there. It's really well.
Lots of boost, not so much eco though.
Yeah, not. So what are you getting for mileage?
I just managed to tease it up over 13 miles per gallon this afternoon coming back from Detroit.
That's awesome.
But you know, granted. You know, it has been very cold here, and, you know, this is the EL King Ranch with the 22-inch wheels, which, you know, do nothing to help fuel economy. You know, I mean, empty, this thing weighs, I think, about 6,300 pounds. So, you know, and the EPA label values are based on the shorter one. So, you know, this, you know, for what it is, you know, if you were actually carrying around eight people, you know, it wouldn't be that terrible.
No, we still get 13 miles to the gallon.
Right, but for one person driving around alone, you know, it's not so great.
Yeah, and I found that, I also just had a 14 F-150 Tremor, which was interesting because the things I didn't like about the old F-150, I find there's still a little bit of that in the Expedition. Like it's a little boomy. Mm-hmm. You know, a little bit loud. The Navigator's a little quieter, but I mean, overall, is this thing an update that's like worth the effort, given that there's new competition from GM with the Suburban and Tahoe and Yukon?
Well, you know, I suspect that this is just a short term thing to tide the Expedition over for another couple of years until they get an all new model. Because, you know, keep in mind the Expedition is built in the same Louisville assembly plant where they build the Super Duty pickups, which are expected to be refreshed later this year. And we saw spy photos of it, you know, as far back as last summer, including the one that burned to a crisp, you know, leaving nothing but the steel frame and the block. Sitting there, you know, I mean, everything else burned completely away. So it looks like the Super Duty is going to be going aluminum, just like the F-150s. And so it seems reasonable to assume that the Expedition will follow suit. And I'm sure that, you know, with nothing else using that 5.4 liter anymore, I'm sure Ford, you know, needed to get rid of that, as well as keep their CAFE numbers up. And so they threw the EcoBoost in there and did some other refreshes to it. So I think this is probably just a short-term refresh, you know, for another 2 years maybe.
Everyone thinks it's ugly. Do you think it's ugly? I mean, the King Ranch interior is clearly garish, but...
Yeah, you know, I don't know if I'd necessarily call it ugly. It's not something I would ever buy. You know, I think it's an improvement over the 2014 model, but it's, you know, it's not great.
Yeah. Well, you know, the big trucks are like, that's a surprisingly competitive field. And it's a really interesting sort of piece of the market to me, because you've got the ones that are, you get sort of like two different buyers. You've got like the 1500 or you know, half ton big truck buyer or you know, big SUV buyer, that they just want the space and they're not really concerned with like the work and towing of it. And so that's a giant vehicle with parts that aren't as heavy duty as you might think. And you can sort of eke decent fuel economy out of them, kind of. And then you've got like the the burly like 4x4, 2500, 3500, you know, the ones that are going to drag a camper across the nation, and you know, those are much more heavy duty, and those are the ones that are really sort of super well cared for, super sort of carefully spec'd out, and they go for big, big money. What's the sticker on your?
This one's just over $65,000.
That's a whole lot of money.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, if you load up a Navigator, you know, I think those will get up, you know, over 75.
Yeah, the Navigator I had was 73, and it was not fully loaded. So,
and you know, like things like the Escalade, you know, you can get those up to, you know, between 80 and 90, I think. I know you used to be able to get them up close to $100,000 with the hybrid and the Platinum series. But, you know, I think if you need, room for eight people and 9,000 pounds of towing capacity, you know, there's not a whole lot of other choices in the marketplace. But, you know, I don't think there's that many people that actually need to take eight people and a 9,000-pound trailer.
It's kind of a specific use, but...
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, if you just need to haul eight people around, you know, I think, you know, a minivan is probably a better choice. You know, like the Kia Sedona I had a couple weeks ago, I think would be a better choice for hauling eight people around. But, hey, you know, to each their own.
Yeah, I'll agree with that. I've got the flip side of that this week. I've got the 2015 Mazda 3.
Oh, I had one of those last week.
Yeah.
Or 2 weeks ago.
It's a heck of a car. Yeah.
This is like
no, I got the sedan, but it's the pretty fully loaded one, which means it costs like it lists out at like I think 26 or something, maybe even cheaper than that. But it's the 6-speed manual and you know the convincing leatherette, the head-up display, their infotainment system and control that's kind of cribbed from BMW. So the thing that I noticed about this, like if you really liked the BMW E30s or the older, you know, new Neue Klasse 2002s, this is your car. Like this drives like those cars. It reminds me of those cars. You know, it, even though it's front-wheel drive, it handles decently. It's got a little bit of Miata in it, so it actually enjoys being driven. It's fun
great
to drive.
Gearbox.
Yeah, the gearbox is good. The clutch sucks, but the rest of the car is just it's really well done. It's light on its feet. It's pretty efficient, and you know it reminds me of what it has that soul of what those cars that we revere used to, and they kind of don't anymore. So I was really impressed with it. Every time I drive a 3 lately, I've been pretty impressed. So I like it to the point where I was like, huh, maybe I should buy one. And I was like, that's a whole lot of money. Even at like,
I mean, you could get one for, you know, closer to $20,000 if you don't get all the fancy stuff. And, you know, you don't need the heads up display. Personally, I found the HUD, you know, with that little pop-up screen to actually be too low to be really useful most of the time.
Yeah, see, I'm short, so it was fine.
Yeah. Okay.
But I mean, it's not like that's not a make or break. I liked all the stuff, but the HUD is sort of in this car. It's not as essential. Like you could do without it. This also has the HID lights that turn in the turns, and I was impressed to see those on a car at this price level, along with some of the other features. Like it's quite well equipped. It's got you know blind spot warning and stuff like that. So it. Surprisingly, at the price level, it's sort of below $30,000. It has a lot of stuff.
Yeah,
And I really prefer it.
It's a fantastic car.
Yeah, I prefer it a lot over the Focus. Although the Focus feels much, you know, much stouter. It feels heavier and more solid going down the road. The Mazda feels a lot lighter on its feet. So that's sort of more endearing to me. And the ergonomics are dead on in the Mazda. They're really, really well done versus the Ford that's like wonky and weird. So it's one of those cars. It's like, it's the driver's car in the segment. And I want Mazda to be successful because they really like all their cars, but I'm not sure that it's selling all that well here. Maybe in Canada it does well because they love Mazdas there, but I don't think it's selling as well as it should because we all love it. So
yeah,
I don't know. Once they make one in brown with a diesel, we'll be all set.
And a wagon.
Yeah. Yeah. That joke's probably getting tired now, but I don't know. I still like it. So yeah, a little small garage this week. So let's hit the topics, because one of the things that has been popping up for the last couple of weeks, and it sort of dovetails nicely with our focus on policy and autonomous vehicle research, is Apple keeps Apple's not really saying anything directly, but
they never do until ready to put it on sale.
These rumors keep popping up that Apple's developing a car, which I think is mostly BS, and that they want to bring it to market by 2020. So, first of all, I think Sam, you and I share the opinion on autonomous cars that they're not coming anytime soon, despite everybody's best efforts. And I'd love to hear sort of your thoughts on that. And then, Juan, I know you follow policy, obviously, so what sort of challenges there might be to actually bringing an autonomous car to the market.
So who wants to go first?
Yeah, who wants to go? You guys want to fight for it?
Go first, Sam. You've got the bigger truck.
Okay.
Right now.
So I've written some stuff recently, and also, you know, in our own the forecasts that my company does, the market forecasts we do, we're projecting that autonomous vehicles, like fully autonomous vehicles, won't be seen in any significant volumes before the late 2020s at the earliest. And I think even that, you know, the more I look at this, you know, the more people I talk to that are actually involved in the development of this stuff, and, you know, some of the existing technology, you know, just looking at the technology and talking to various people, I think, you know, even that might be optimistic for getting fully autonomous vehicles out on the open road. Now, you know, I think where we'll start seeing some applications is in certain confined locations, you know, things like, you know, the Google campus and, you know, various restricted locations, maybe dedicated lanes for autonomous buses, that sort of thing, where they don't have to interact with regular vehicles. But I think from a technology standpoint, although, you know, the engineers understand, you know, have figured out the basics of how to make an autonomous vehicle work under ideal conditions, the problem is the real world, you know, as both of you guys have seen in the last couple of weeks, you know, unlike in Northern California, you know, the rest of us actually experience weather. And that's a problem for autonomous vehicles. In fact, it's a problem for the vehicles that we have today with just advanced driver assist systems. You know, most of the sensors in these systems, you know, when the weather gets bad, they don't work. And you
know, they don't work well. I wind up
no, they don't work at all in a lot of cases.
I once had a Volvo actually complain at me that cruise control is unavailable because its radar sensor iced up.
Yeah.
And so I didn't have any kind of cruise, nothing.
Yeah, I mean, a few weeks ago, you know, when it, you know, we had a heavy snowfall here, and I was sitting in that Kia Sedona, waiting in a parking lot for somebody, and you know, just the snow coming down, what had the parking sensors, the ultrasonic parking sensors, going crazy, you know, think from all the snowflakes coming down, you know, and you know, if you think about it, you know, if you drive somewhere where they use road salt, you know, you're constantly cleaning your windshield. You get the salt crusting up on your headlights and your taillights, you know, and all that stuff. You know, when that salt crusts up on your laser sensors and your radar sensors, they don't work. You know, it's not a matter of, you know, degraded performance. There's no performance. So you know, until they figure out, you know, some of these really fundamental issues, like how to make these things work in anything but, you know, sunny days on dry roads, you know, first of all, you know, I don't think consumers are going to be willing to pay the many thousands of dollars price premium for all this hardware if most of the time, the times when they would actually want the car to take over from them, you know, when it's most stressful for them to drive, that the vehicle won't be able to. And then, you know, the other problem that we've got is that, you know, even with the driver assist systems, and as we get into semi-autonomous systems, you know, for the scenarios where the vehicle cannot function on its own, they have to be able to hand off control back to the driver, which means that drivers are not going to be able to just sit back and read a book or, you know, surf the web while they're cruising along. They're going to have to keep paying attention even while the car is nominally doing the driving so that they can be ready to take over at a moment's notice. So things like that Mercedes FO15 concept that we saw at CES and the Detroit Auto Show with the seats that swivel around, that ain't going to happen anytime in the foreseeable future, because the driver is going to have to be looking ahead where the vehicle's going and ready to take on control at any time.
Well, see, and that's a good sort of segue into the issues around it, legally and in terms of insurance and just clearing room for these cars to share the road. There's going to be a transition period, even if these do happen. I don't think they're going to happen anytime soon. But everybody's frothing at the mouth about this. And, what happens if your autonomous car gets in an accident? Who's liable? Is it the car? Is it the automaker? Is it you? Is it, what's the temperature of the sort of legislative opinion on this stuff? Other than these people don't drive anyway and they would love the machine to take over.
Well, I mean, kind of going back to what Sam said, as far as consumer acceptance, when you start getting into these false positives, which is something I had in the Jeep, I even had for a little while. I got a lot of false positives on the crash and forward collision warning.
Well, that's because you were just probably closing too fast. You had an SRT8.
but it was the same thing. And so that's always a concern, is where you get dependence on a technology that, the false positives outweigh the advanced safety features to where it's turned off. And so that's going to be kind of interesting going forward in a lot of these line of sight scenarios where you have rain or obstructions or things from the road come up, and you're kind of thinking because it's scary. It's really scary when you're driving and there's nothing in front of you, and all of a sudden a bag or something flies up from the road and covers your sensor, and then your brakes start preloading going down the freeway at 65. So.
But that sounds like something that actually happened to you.
It did. It was fun. consumer dependence on safety technology has kind of been a thing back when we started talking blind spot warning early in the early 2000s. I mean, I remember seeing, that like Ford did a presentation to NHTSA years ago, and that was one of the concerns with blind spot warning, is people would look for the orange dot. If it wasn't there, they were coming over. So people stop looking back now that they have these, this technology to kind of lean on.
I mean, those people who actually looked back in the first place,
clearly that doesn't apply to people here in Michigan where no one actually uses their mirrors.
I find though that there's certain technology that's arrived, right? Like anti-lock brakes. And even at that, you still have to understand how it works. Most people think that anti-lock brakes would make you stop more quickly, and that's completely not the case. They actually lengthen
not stopping. In most scenarios.
There's always sort of it all depends on the variables. But the key with anti-lock brakes was, back in the day, you had cars that they'd unload the rear tires and then they'd spin, and you'd have to be a much better driver to catch it and keep it, not crashing off the road and burning you to death. So
right.
It's a great scenario.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the question that I'm trying to understand for autonomous cars is, are we pursuing it as a society in terms of safety, or is much of the churn on the topic more about marketing, first to market? Nissan proclaimed their 2020 goal and whatnot. So I don't know which is actually the driving force.
It's actually both. I mean, last few years average about 34,000 fatalities a year in the United States in traffic accidents. And, everybody wants to cut that number down to zero. Everybody's got a goal. I mean, you'll never get to zero, but everyone wants to reduce that number as much as possible.
Take V2V, for example, which is similar to autonomy, right? So if
not
V2V,
exactly, but
it's more effective in terms of line
actually,
of sight.
Yeah, no, I agree. I actually think in the
because LIDAR, line of sight's not going to address intersection crashes that are impending, like left turns where you get most of your fatalities. So if today we began phase in, this is NHTSA saying this, if we phased in V2V today, it would take 39 years before we actually got to the actual peak reduction in fatalities, which I think the highest estimate was like 1,000.
Mm-hmm. What?
So every car in that was pulled directly from the notice of public rulemaking, and Mercedes-Benz even
80% reduction.
No, Mercedes-Benz even echoed it again, or Mercedes-Benz, a couple of other automakers echoed it in the thing. It's basically saying, or no, it's Fiat. I'm sorry. In Fiat's response, they were basically saying that to NHTSA that, hey, look, at 39 years, you're looking at, I think it was, I forget the lower number, but the high end was 1,038, was fatalities attributed to V to V.
The cost of V to V is a lot lower than autonomous systems. And, you know, the thing is, I think, you know, the implementation rate is actually going to be a lot faster than that, because unlike with autonomous systems, with V2V, if you only relied on new vehicles getting it, then it would take you, several decades to get to near full deployment where you'd get maximum benefit. But I think what we're actually going to see is there's going to be a lot of retrofit systems, and also systems that are able to use smartphones to provide some of that V2V functionality. And
yeah, I was just going to say, something like an app like Waze that integrates, you've got sort of the user base generating the info, everything's talking to your smartphone talks to your car. So there's embedded systems already in cars from the last 5 years. Do they release a software patch that allows some V2V functionality based on your phone?
The V2V, what they call the DSRC, dedicated short range communications, is based on a variation of Wi-Fi that's called 802.11p.
Right, I've heard of that.
So basically, the FCC set aside some spectrum at around 5.9 gigahertz for DSRC communications, which is what V2V and V2P and vehicle to infrastructure are all using. And so because it's based on Wi-Fi, you can actually modify. You can't really do it with just a software patch, but you do need some, or at least to make it useful with a phone, you need to optimize the hardware a little bit. But it's mainly a matter of the power management. Last September here in Detroit at the ITS World Congress, I saw a demo from Qualcomm, who make a lot of the smartphone chips. And they and other companies that make the chips and the phones are working on new power management stuff for the Wi-Fi radios in the phones, so that they'll be able to do the DSRC communications, the V2V stuff, without draining the battery really fast.
Maybe that's why Apple's looking at your car.
Right. Once you get that, when you've got DSRC in new smartphones, in addition to having a vehicle to vehicle, you've also got vehicle to pedestrian, vehicle to cyclist. So everybody who's carrying a smartphone becomes a beacon, and can provide alerts to the vehicles around them. So, when somebody's about to step out onto the street, you can get an alert, that, hey, there's a pedestrian, 100 feet up ahead of you on the right, or there's a cyclist, coming up to the intersection, all these other things to extend the driver's situational awareness.
So, Juan, you were going to chime in.
The technology behind V2V is the easy part. I mean, retrofit of these things are going to be easy. No one's arguing that. But when you look at some of the comments from like Harley Davidson, for example, and their comment back to NHTSA basically said V2V standards should be conditioned upon, preceded by, federal state liability limitations for manufacturers. Mercedes-Benz said liability as attributed to these V2V technologies will be an onerous topic. So the technology is really easy. The two challenges are, one, liability, which is a huge issue. And Mercedes basically tries to outline it saying, if the challenge is because you're talking to something else now. So there's an outside entity, and who's the liability? If the vehicle receives data from, say, a vehicle to infrastructure, transponder, and I receive the wrong information and I get in the crash, how can Mercedes-Benz be at fault? And how can the driver be at fault? But the other underlying challenge too is you know, the bigger challenge is who's going to operate the Security Credential Management System, or SCMS. Uh-huh. And that was one of the things Tesla, you know, wrote about in their response to NHTSA, basically saying you don't have the technology to be able to transmit data as fast as you're going to need to transmit it to make this a viable system. And so, I mean, on the surface, V2V looks really easy because we can put these in cars, we can put these in watches, we can put these on bicycles. Who's going to run it? Because the government has basically raised their hand and said, we are not going to operate this. We'll set standards, but we're not going to actually run the network. So who's going to pay for the network and who's going to run the network?
Well, the network itself, you know, aside from vehicle to infrastructure, like all the V2P and V2V stuff is all peer-to-peer. It's an ad hoc network. You know, what you're talking about is the mechanism for updating the security certificates, you know, because all the communications, you know, they have a security system built into this. It's like SSL, essentially SSL. You know, when you go to your bank website or to, you know, Amazon or whatever, you know, instead of an HTTP address, it's an HTTPS address. So they're using the certificate-based security system. And, you know, what you're talking about is the mechanism for providing updated security certificates, you know, as the certificates expire. So when a DSRC device, you know, whether it's a car or a smartphone or whatever is shipped from the factory, it'll have a batch of security certificates that are preloaded. And then over time, those certificates expire and they need to be replenished with fresh certificates. So that's one of the things they're still working on, is the mechanism for how those certificates are going to be periodically updated. You know, and they're looking at a number of different mechanisms. You know, one of them is using satellite radio, using, you know, the same system that they use for like Sirius traffic updates, you know, to download these certificates, you know, because there's not a lot of data there that's needed. So you don't need a whole lot of bandwidth, and that, you know, it's not something that needs to be updated all that frequently.
So, yeah, I mean, I have no doubt that they'll be able to make it work in that sense. I like, this is kind of like our turbine car or our jetpack of this century at this point, you know. But what needs to be cleared out of the way to make this happen? Like, you have a radio device that needs to communicate. So there's FCC stuff there because, you know, it needs to be tested and validated and not interfere and yet be powerful enough. You know, I'm not real confident that the maximum 3-watt transmitter or whatever that's in my smartphone is going to do it. And do it reliably, given that I can't even have a cell phone conversation without dropping the call twice over my commute to work. It's just the tech can be made to work. It's sort of like, what are the other obstacles in the way? You've got user adoption, you've got the liability issues, you've got the other legal ramifications around it. Like, you know, and then there's, what about when the cars are actually driving themselves? Like, how do we account for that?
Well, in autonomous vehicles, you know, in the V2X communications is just one small part of the bigger picture, you know, what it takes to control the vehicles. You know, so, you know, you can actually do autonomous vehicles without the communications component of it. But it's not going to be as robust a system. You know, you really want to have communications as part of the system in order to provide information about things that are outside of the line of sight. Like, for example, you know, two vehicles approaching a blind intersection. You know, so you can get some information that way. And for things like platooning, you know, where you've got car, you know, multiple vehicles following in close formation, one behind the other, you know, and the lead vehicle would be passing messages along to the following vehicles, you know, about when to brake, when to turn, all that sort of thing. So, you know, that the communications part is just one small aspect, you know, and I think, you know, we're going to see the communications long before we ever see any autonomous vehicles on the road.
So, like, how much sort of light and heat is being generated in the capital around this stuff? Is this like a topic that comes up from time to time, or is it something that's being actively worked on? I mean, I know that NHTSA is under a bunch of pressure on other stuff.
Yeah, no, I think more than having cars drive themselves, I think DC would probably be better served finding a road that would repair itself.
Absolutely.
That might take care of the larger looming issue of the Highway Trust Fund and the creative financing that's probably going to refill those coffers. That gets into a whole nother issue with how we pay for the road itself that we're all trying to drive on without actually driving. That really does kind of take over a lot of what's going on in D.C. right now. I mean, sometime here in the spring, we're going to have the Department of Transportation Inspector General's report regarding how NHTSA handled the GM recall stuff. So that's kind of something that's still pending.
That should
be coming soon. Yeah. Yeah. I assume it's going to reflect a lot of the same things that GAO found there, the Government Accountability Office. But yeah, I mean, right now, the big issue was Highway Trust Fund. Going forward, there's a couple of small things within NHTSA that they're looking at. I mean, V2V right now is kind of, I think, first and foremost in the autonomous game anyways. That's really where they're going. And they're being very cautious in how they do this. You know, there's no mandate to safety technologies tied to V2V, for example. So it gives the automakers kind of, free rein as to if they want to tie active or passive safety to V2V. That would be up to each individual automaker. But I think one thing that's going to be interesting as we get closer to the CAFE midterm review is whether or not there'll be a bigger push from automakers as they roll out things like, autonomous emergency braking, forward collision warning, whether they really start to push for reductions in carbon emissions based on crash avoidance, and whether they start asking formally for CAFE credits, and that could really spur a big push into these lower cars, if you will. If I can put crash avoidance in a Mazda 3 or something and gain CAFE credits, then that might start to take off some of that price that you would be paying as a consumer, because now I'm getting CAFE credits for it as well. I mean, that's just one idea I've heard kind of tossed about.
EPA is even. Yeah, has anybody even really brought that up formally, and is it something that you think they would even consider?
Yeah, years ago, Mercedes they talked about it very briefly in the way they captured off-cycle credits. Some of it dealt with start-stop, but they did bring up, and what was interesting, the way Mercedes went about this is Progressive Snapshot actually sells the data back to the automakers. Like for Mercedes, for example, they were getting data on their idle times of their vehicles. And so they could go to Progressive and ask them to send idle times for Mercedes-Benz vehicles in certain regions of the country. So that's kind of a neat thing that I didn't realize. It actually happened behind the scenes with some of the insurance data. It's sold back to the automakers, the way I understood the request anyways.
I'm aware of that.
Yeah,
makes sense though.
See, I mean that, yeah. that sounds perfectly fine if it's a thing that you opt into.
What I really
don't like is the idea that that sort of thing will someday be like mandatory and put in your car regardless, whether you want it or not. That just scares the hell out of me. First of all, second of all, I mean, and we've seen all these scares about, and I feel like it's actually a small risk at the moment. But there's always, every couple of months there's another article about so and so hacked a car and they got in through OnStar or whatever, and it's like, yeah, okay, you can do it, but there's not really anything valuable there yet. There's no real reason for a hacker
depends on which systems you're talking about. I mean, if you're talking about something like Ford Sync, then no, you're right. There's not anything valuable there because it's not, some of the other infotainment systems.
Yeah, but I mean, there's not
vehicle controls. But something like OnStar, or Hyundai Blue Link and some of the other systems, the embedded telematics systems, there is a real risk there because, those systems are in fact tied to some of the vehicle controls, like OnStar. One of the features that they offer is stolen vehicle slowdown and recovery. So if you report your car stolen and it's got OnStar, you call the cops and say, hey, my vehicle's been stolen. You call OnStar and say, my vehicle's been stolen. And the OnStar data center can call the vehicle and force it to slow down so that so that it can't get into a high-speed chase.
But see, there's always, like, I just come back to, like, the idea of guerrilla warfare. What if you take a piece of tinfoil or a sheet of lead and just cover that antenna? Not going to work. And you're going to steal the car. But in terms of value, I'm saying something like, it's not like hacking a laptop or somebody's smartphone where you've got like credit card numbers and access to bank information. Like,
right. It's definitely a lot harder to hack. And, you know, other than, you know, like the 60 Minutes story a few weeks ago, you know, with DARPA, where they did that demo with the Impala, which, you know, in typical 60 Minutes style, they didn't actually tell you anything useful. all the previous demos that have been done of supposed car hacking, every one of those demos have all required physical access to the car first, you know, and the car was tampered with before they did the demo.
Right. Well, and then like there's lots of mischief you can, like mayhem you can cause, you know, like you can shut a car down. I mean,
if you have physical access to the car and you're tampering with the car before you do that, you know, there's all kinds of things you can do with that same access to a car that has no connectivity.
I mean, just take the lug nuts.
I can loosen your lug nuts without
open up the brake bleeder valves. I mean, you know, there's all kinds of things you can do.
We should not give anybody too many ideas. So, like, all of this stuff, it sounds really cool. I'm going to sound like an old guy now.
Because you are.
Yes, I am. We have a wall of us at work, and I put up, you know, Dan Robb, 37 years old on the outside, 107 years old on the inside. Get off my lawn. But the point I want to make is, like, all this stuff is sort of like it's a phantom tax on the citizen and the car buyer, right? Like, you're pushing all of this stuff, you know, to be developed. And I agree with the stringent CAFE standards. As much as people complain about that, that's why you can breathe in L.A. today. And it's not like Beijing, and automakers, you know, cried and kicked and screamed about that. And then they implemented these systems that weren't very good. Everybody, you know, hated the way the cars performed because the technology was in its infancy. Look at what we got now. We got a 700 horsepower supercharged V8.
In a
production car. So it'll get there. So I like the idea of the ambitious standard for something like fuel economy, because that's greenhouse gas reduction. There's a lot of other benefits to that. But the idea that active safety technology is a panacea for just spending the money to train drivers. Like, isn't that cheaper and less expensive and overall better, because it keeps people out of the emergency room and it reduces the sort of the burden on our first responders and it reduces the payouts that insurance companies have. Like, wouldn't that be better?
I would agree with you, Dan. You know, but the reality is that, you know, even when you train people, you know, humans, you know, eventually do stupid things. You know, and you know, if you look at the causes of most of the accidents, most accidents are caused by the stupid things that humans do.
Well, not always stupid though either. I mean, when you really dive deep into like distracted driving, for example, a lot of it is inattentiveness. Like, that's not really stupidity, but it's just, we just stop paying attention at some point. I don't know when that happened, but.
You talked about ABS earlier, you know, and when I started, you know, when I graduated and started working, you know, in engineering in 1990, you know, working on ABS systems around that time, around 1990-91, I think, you know, NHTSA did a study. They looked at several car models that were available with and without ABS. And they compiled the accident data from those vehicles. And, you know, what they found was that on the cars that had ABS, the multi-vehicle accident rates went down. But the vehicles with ABS, the rate of single vehicle accidents, you know, run off the road accidents, actually went up. Because what happened was, I think, you know, as with blind spot information systems, you know, the drivers got overconfident, you know, and they expected the systems to do more than they could, and so they started doing stupid things. You know, they started driving more aggressively, you know, under the same conditions, and they ended up having more, you know, it was a different kind. It shifted from one kind of accident to another.
Yeah, but see, that's implementation without education, without training.
Right.
So, yes, obviously, that's kind of an issue. And I feel like that's like, I don't understand the mentality of like, wouldn't you just love to sit back and relax during your commute? It's like, no, I love to drive. I don't care whether it's my commute or not. Like, well, I enjoy driving. So,
you know, when I was driving to Dearborn every day for 3 years, you know, I would have loved to have had an autonomous car that could, you know, because it was just a straight shot, you know, 25 miles across Interstate 94. Yeah, you know, and there was nothing interesting or fun about that drive. And I would have loved to have been able to put it in autonomous mode and just, you know, sit back and relax. But, you know, there's a lot of other times when I do like to drive. I think the problem, you know, I agree with what you're saying. You know, none of this is going to be a panacea. You know, even if we get autonomous vehicles, you know, sensors fail. There's always going to be scenarios when the systems don't work. And eventually the drivers are going to have to take over and they've got to be prepared. And you're right. They need to be trained.
I just think that, like, you know, like Juan's saying, you know, we're going to get a system in place. We're going to mandate something that's going to take 40 years to pay off. And even at that point, the payoff is going to be so low compared to the much more immediate. It's a lower tech solution, right? It's not flashy.
Yeah, I mean, it's backup cameras. It's sentimental. It's whatever. It's emotional. I mean, a lot of the stuff behind backup camera mandate didn't, you know, cost per million lives saved wasn't really there. But you know what? There was a couple of kids brought up in the media and it, you know, it really touched a lot of people and it kind of gained traction. You know, whether it was really going to save lives, the number of lives we thought it might or we think it will. But again, it's, you know, and of course, you know, Honda rolls out the marketing, you know, we're the first to have all vehicles, you know, standard with backup cameras. And so,
I mean, has a life ever been saved by the center high-mounted stop lamp?
I, you know what? I would argue that probably has because that's such a hard thing to put too fine a point on. You know, like you can the center high-mounted stop lamp. It's up in your eye level, sort of. It's not down in your periphery. It's bright. So yeah, probably. But
yeah, but I mean, at the same time, I mean. You know, if the goal really is to reduce fatalities, you know, we're looking at, you know, ways to supplement the human. At the same time, you know, we have to keep in mind that, granted, not all fatalities, but, you know, half of people still, you know, roundabout don't wear their seatbelt who are killed. Not to say they wouldn't have been killed if they were belted. But I think in 2012, of passenger vehicle fatalities, 52% were unbelted. So, we're creating this entire network of system to more or less help people who couldn't help themselves put on a seatbelt.
And so, right, and then you wind up with airbags that kill people. I mean, so that's the flip side.
Yeah. I mean, I guess my question is, and it sounds very gruesome, but at what point do we just say, you know what, 10,000 people a year die in accidents? Good enough.
Well, accidents have continued to fall. They are at the lowest point that they've ever been.
I think actually the number of accidents has gone up.
I was going to say
fatalities have gone down.
I think it ticked up.
If it depends on, you know, as always with statistics on how you look at it. And if you look at it in terms of the fatality rates,
per
100 million miles driven, you know,
it's the lowest it's ever been.
It's the lowest it's ever been. And I mean, you know, the absolute number of accidents in any given year, you know, tends to go up and down a bit, you know, with the number of miles that we drive, you know. So, like, you know, 2008, 2009, when fuel prices were high, you know, people didn't have money, they were driving less, you know, the number of accidents went down, and it went up a bit after that. But, you know, that's because we were driving more miles, but the number of accidents per mile went down. And in fact, you know, since about 1960 or 61, you know, it's down more than 90% since that time.
Yeah, cool, because we have cars that don't spear you with the steering column or just fall apart when they hit stuff, even though they're really heavy. You know, I love that myth of like, oh, that's the good solid car. You see that, you know, but even now people are like, oh, that car just fell apart when it hit something. It's, yeah, it's supposed to do that. Yeah. You ever see an F1 car crash? I mean, like, shit just flies everywhere.
I want all that kinetic energy.
Yeah, exactly. I do not want that in my body. Thanks. And, you know, yeah, it's sad when your car sort of you know, car you really liked sort of gives its life for you, but then you walk away and you don't have.
Do you want the car to give its life, or do you want to give your life?
Right, exactly. Yeah. You know, even with the dog, right? We just got a dog not too long ago. I don't know if you guys knew, and whatever. But the I'm like calculating out, like, okay, so we've got the cage in the back for him. I still want him to be in a harness because, and I'm like doing the, I'm trying to do like the force calculation. I'm like, he's 30 pounds. In an accident, even if it's like three times the force of gravity and it's like exponential, I'm like, he's going to weigh 6,000 pounds or something. You know, he's going to hit that cage with 6,000 pounds of force or whatever it was. I forget exactly what it was. But it's like, even the spot welds on the cage aren't going to hold him. He's going to fly in, and then we're going to have metal moving around in the car and it's going to hit us. And I was like, yeah. So there's a lot of sort of things we can do to educate ourselves before we start to cost ourselves money by mandating system. I just feel like it's not sexy legislation at that point. And speaking of more legislation too, one of the other things that comes up all the time now is EVs and subsidies, and especially with sort of our low fuel prices, everybody's sort of starting to say the thing again too, like, well, electric vehicles are going nowhere because the fuel cost dropped. And is that now, are we going to tinker with the market by subsidizing those? Is that wise? You know, we can move a little bit away.
We've been doing that all along anyway. You know, in fact, the sales of plug-in vehicles, you know, both plug-in hybrids and battery electrics, really hasn't gone down that much, you know, with fuel prices. You know, the correlation isn't there for those. It is for non-plug-in hybrids, but it's not for plug-ins.
Yeah. It just seems like that's something like, is it even wise to try to spur adoption that way?
Well, I guess, you know, it depends on how you look at it. You know, I mean, you know, part of the reason why these vehicles are more expensive right now is because of relatively low volumes. You know, they're not selling all that many of them. You know, so you don't have the economies of scale that, you know, you have for more traditional technologies that have been around for a long time. You know, so, you know, how do you get the economies of scale? You got to get people to buy them. But if they're expensive and people won't buy them, you know, the only way to get that market jump started is with some sort of subsidies. You know, the problem is, you know, that assumes that increasing the volumes is going to bring the cost down. And that may or may not necessarily be the case when it comes to batteries. We don't actually have evidence that increasing the scale is going to bring the cost down sufficiently to create an organic demand for these vehicles. And at which point, you know, now you got to think, well, you know, if there's not, you know, if we're not going to be able to get the cost down to the point where people are going to want to buy them without subsidies, you know, now, you know, what's the argument for doing this? And so, you know, then you got to start looking, you know, beyond just the raw cost of the vehicle, you know, and if you start factoring in all the other associated costs, you know, with using fossil fuels, you know, the various societal costs and, you know, environmental costs, you know, but that, as with, you know, the other things we just talked about, you know, the equation becomes a lot more difficult and people want simple solutions to complex problems.
Always, especially if we're talking about grandstanding on C-SPAN.
Yeah. or MSNBC or Fox or, you know, any other news show.
Yeah, well, so I guess one of my questions that pops up is like, we've had 45, 50 years of complaining about dependence on foreign oil. Turns out that foreign really means Canada, and then now we are actually producing most of our oil domestically for the current
term. Not the oil, gas, but not
oil. Gasoline, I'm sorry. Either way, you know, we say foreign oil, and we don't put a fine point on it. But we're not importing what we used to. When we switch to battery technology, if that's where we're going, we're looking at raw materials that are coming from other places that are not necessarily friendly. Do we wind up with political issues there too? And is that sort of the next frontier that cars are going to sort of drag us into?
Yes.
Does everybody in Washington realize that? No, I mean, like that's something that like, there's a lot of sort of there's chatter about it.
Putting on the kind of national security hat, if you will. I mean, there's when it gets down to a lot of the technology and stuff in, say, electric vehicles, it's not too far off from what you would find in, say, the F-35 in terms of, you know, some of the semi-earth, you know, a lot of the rare earth materials that go into that. Yeah. So I think there's been a lot of reports, at least in the last 4 or 5 years, looking at, you know, the U.S. Strategic Reserve opening some more mines. And the challenge with opening mines is you kind of have this, well, you have to go through, the EPA process or through the Bureau of Land Management to grant some of these permits to reopen mines and stuff. And so I think there's some of that happening now. I don't know it that well to go into which mines and which materials. But again, I it's hard to predict, you know, today in 5 years what materials might make up batteries.
Yeah, and you know, engineers are actively working to try to reduce or eliminate, you know, a lot of the more problematic materials like the rare earth metals. You know, for example, in the second gen Chevy Volt that's coming later this summer.
Yeah, but yeah. I mean, the issue is the rare earth metals are those are the ones that give us the best sort of bang for our buck, right? I mean.
Until we synthesize them.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, they're finding other ways to do it, you know, to achieve the same kind of efficiencies without using those materials. So the Volt, you know, in the new drive unit, you know, it's got two motors just like the first generation Volt, but one of them uses no rare earth metals at all, and the other one it's got 40% less rare earth metals. You know, so they've substantially reduced the amount of rare earth metals that they have to use, and they're actively trying to develop technologies that don't rely on those materials at all.
Yeah, I mean, it's still, though, you know, one battery in a Tesla has about, I don't know, 4 gallons worth of gasoline in it in terms of its range and its energy content.
Not even that.
Not even. So,
it's about 2.5 gallons.
It's okay. So I was being generous.
One gallon of gas is about 33.7 kilowatt hours.
Yeah, so that's kind of a gap to close. I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think we're going to have. We should wrap the topic. But in terms of your predictions, autonomous cars, in terms of the policy and the actual sort of technology being viable, next 20 years, next. I mean, because Apple says 2020, I think they're not.
No, Apple really hasn't said squat.
I think honestly, Apple's going to be they want to be a supplier. They're talking to Magna. It makes a lot more sense for them to get into the supplier game.
Actually, you know, I mean, one of the things I wrote last week is I think, if Apple were to get into the car business, they would do it only because they actually don't expect autonomous vehicles. You know, because I think if Apple thinks that, you know, we're going to go predominantly autonomous vehicles in the near future, there's actually far less of an argument for an Apple vehicle. Because if you've got autonomous vehicles, then now, you know, you don't really, you know, it kind of drives away from having personal vehicle ownership. You know, if the vehicles truly are autonomous, you know, then why do you even need to own a vehicle? You know, just, you know, summon one with your phone when you need it on demand.
That's called Uber.
Yeah. Well, yeah, Uber or Zipcar or, you know, any number of other services. You know, so you summon a vehicle on demand when you need it, get in, it goes, you know, takes you to where you need to go. You get out, it goes off and picks up the next person. And so if you, now once you've got into that kind of scenario where, you know, the vehicles become more or less commodities. You know, the main reason for Apple to do a vehicle at all, if they were to do one, and I'm far from convinced that they will ever produce one. I think they're definitely looking at it, but I don't believe that. You know, right? I'm skeptical that they will actually end up doing it. But you know, one of the main reasons why they would want to do it is to create a better user experience for drivers. And if, you know, the vehicles are commodified in that way, you know, where, you know, people aren't owning vehicles, then there's little benefit to an Apple user experience when people aren't, you know, actually buying the vehicles and, having that experience all the time, that person, you know, that specific Apple user experience. So I think if we have autonomous vehicles, there's less likelihood of an Apple car.
Sounds like autonomous vehicles will make an awesome quick rinse sort of public transportation system. Anybody thought of that?
Personal point-to-point mass transit.
Yeah, I think we should do that instead of light rail. What do you think, Juan?
Well, it would probably be more cost-effective.
Way more cost-effective.
But no then rails. Again, but then again, but what are you gonna? Where are you gonna cut your ribbons at, though? I mean, you know, you have to have ribbon cutting ceremonies, or there's no reason to have congressmen. But
but the way you say that, it seems to imply that you think there is a reason to have congressmen.
Yeah, but I mean, I agree with Sam to some extent, but I also think there's that kind of underlying human behavior. It would be a large behavioral shift in how we just operate, particularly in rural areas as well. I don't see, you know, in Midwestern Ohio, Appalachia, people adopting these, you know, multi-autonomous shared vehicles. It sounds great in city. I mean, Car2Go really went there when Mercedes had a overabundance of small cars that were horrible that no one was buying. They created a subsidiary, and now they have something to do with those small cars. And I think that would, you know, autonomous vehicles would make a great extension in something that already exists, something like a Car2Go. Rather than you walking to the car, now it'll come the two blocks to you, because Americans are that lazy. But I think
it's like Wally.
Well, it's not just a matter of laziness, you know, because I mean, if you think about it, especially in urban areas, you know, and the world is getting increasingly urbanized, one of the big, waste factors is people drive, one of the ways we waste a lot of energy from driving is people trolling around looking for a parking space. You know, if you don't have to waste that time.
That's because they won't ride the metro in their city because it keeps catching fire.
Well, okay. But
when it snows and they don't run. Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, if you eliminate that need to, I mean, and this is, you know, this is one of the arguments in favor of autonomous vehicles. If you can eliminate that need to waste time and energy looking for a parking space, then.
You can waste time and energy doing other stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You have the potential to save a lot of fuel.
Yeah. And you know, there's the greatest potential to save fuel is eliminating the need for people to all commute into a central hub and sit at a computer all day. But we don't have automakers pursuing that.
It's funny. This winter has been so brutal that I've worked from home the last four Mondays or three Mondays, something like that.
But we need a blizzard to justify you being able to do that. You know?
Right, which is stupid because I am so much more efficient when I'm not spending 3 hours out of my day commuting. Quote unquote, get to work earlier because I just open the laptop and bang, I'm on the VPN. It's like I'm there. So, and I realize that, you know, I'm part of the knowledge economy, so I can do that. Then not every job you can do that, but there's a ton of us on the road in one, you know, a car for one person it makes a lot of sense where, you know, get me off the road and then I can drive when I enjoy to, you know, when I want to for enjoyment.
I think there's a lot of efficiencies to be gained still in that. And maybe it'll be a cultural evolutionary shift once, you know, the older generations kind of move on, the kind of cubicle farmed generation. But I think one of the things going back to autonomous cars is, I almost think that because the federal government has kind of had this hands off, like, here's a guideline, guys, should you go forward? Here are some great ideas. I think as states actually start to go forward, like Nevada and California, and start issuing their own internal policies and certifications, I think that is almost going to force the federal government into the role of creating a mandate of sorts, at least something stronger than a guideline. Because the guideline really has no, you can't enforce a guideline per se from the federal standpoint. So I think as states start developing their own policies, I think the federal government almost has to create a standard just so there's some continuity amongst all the states. I mean, I think NHTSA is just not there either from they're not ready to get there, or they just don't have the expertise in-house.
There's nobody, either at the automaker, the state level, the suppliers, the feds, that really understands, what the answers need to be to all these questions that we still have about autonomous vehicles, to set a guideline at this point.
Right.
You know, it's still way too early to be talking about any kind of regulations for these things, other than, you know, providing, you know, like, you know, what some of the states are doing, like California and Nevada, providing a mechanism to enable testing and development of these vehicles.
Right.
You know, yeah, well, as far as regulating the performance or, you know, what they have to do, you know, we don't know enough to do that yet.
Well, yeah, well, setting a federal safety standard is the easy part. But again, like the commonality and the common thread I've read, whether it be suppliers or automakers on anything that's been submitted or written, is all liability reform has to come before anything else.
Because yes. They don't want to hold the bag.
Yeah, that's a valid concern.
Yeah, it is.
And so I think until someone's ready to take on the liability at the state level, at the federal level, I mean, now there are pitches out there for cybersecurity insurance for your autonomous car. So in case it gets hacked, you're not culpable.
Well, I mean, I think that that's actually what's driven a lot of automaker implementation of the data recording. The onboard data recording that is their cars are now capable of is they can prove that, you know, their vehicle, they can at least better prove that their vehicle wasn't, you know, the actual source of the unintended acceleration or whatever.
And that's kind of where Mercedes-Benz was coming from with the fact that when you get into V2V, specifically not autonomous, but V2V, it's hard because you have these outside transmissions coming into the car. So the Mercedes-Benz software and product may not be to blame. So who's to blame at that point? Is it the malfunctioning red light, and therefore is the state or county municipality to blame for the accident if it transmitted an incorrect signal and your car got into an accident?
Man, you guys are scaring me. I'm just going to be like on I'm going to go to Walk Blog.
Just never walk, never leave your house again, right. Dan.
Today on Shoe Blog. And even there.
Well, you know, the thing is, you know, for all the problems that human drivers cause, you know, on the other hand, you know, humans have a huge advantage over computers. You know, humans understand nuance,
mm-hmm.
or at least most
some
of
some humans.
Yeah. But, you know, in terms of, you know, you look out the windshield and you see things, you know, a human is far better able to distinguish between a child running across the road, or a bag, you know, being blown across by the wind, you know, or a dog running out in front of you, than any of the computer systems, you know, that we have right now. So, you know, that ability to distinguish nuance, you know, in terms of image processing and decision making, you know, is actually far better among humans than it is among automated systems right now, and probably will be for quite some time to come. So, you know, despite, you know, all I was saying about, you know, stupid human tricks, the reality is, you know, in a lot of ways, you know, we're much better able to cope and adapt with situations. You know, I mean, one of the things I've talked about in the past is, you know, just think about, you know, every new vehicle you get into today, you know, 2015, you know, virtually every vehicle has a switch on the dashboard that allows you to turn off the traction control.
Kinda.
Well, no, I mean, I'm not talking about the stability control. I'm talking about the traction control. You can turn off the traction control completely. And the reason why that switch is there is because when you get into deep snow, the traction control system doesn't know how to deal with that.
It melts your brake pads pretty well.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Or it, you know, it just sits there and, you know, you don't go anywhere. And so they put the off switch for the traction control so that when you're in snow, you can actually get the vehicle moving, because the system, even after 20 years in production, still doesn't know how to deal with that. You know, and that's, you know, something that's fairly simple. You know, when you've got systems that are trying to recognize potholes, you know, and figure out what to do with them, you know, or all the other things that are going to be on the road in the real world. You know, there's a big difference between testing in the lab and testing on the real world. You know, and in real world conditions, and humans are actually far better able to deal with the, you know, the nuances of that decision making process than any of the automated systems.
Yeah, and you know what else humans are far better at? Deciding when it's okay to break the law slightly.
Yeah.
And what I mean is, a lot of these cars, the presumption is, you know, they're going to be programmed to not do certain things. You know, if there's a car in front of you that's just kind of stalled and there's a double yellow on the left, your car is not going to know to go around. You know, going the speed limit, for example, can you imagine? So is everyone going to be comfortable sitting in their vehicle going the posted limit?
No.
So there's all those different types of like normal human behavior. Well,
those
of
are
driving.
Just suggestions, right?
Right. Yes, I would never, ever condone someone violating any posted speed limit.
The posted limits are just suggestions.
Oh, well, no. Look, not in Virginia. In Virginia, you go to jail.
Oh, that's true, yeah.
Until I see an officer driving on the road at the posted limit, that's a whole other podcast.
Yes.
And I should,
Cadillac.
Most of my commute is actually spent well below the posted limit, stopping and going.
Thanks, traffic.
So let's. I think we've covered the bejesus out of this topic. Did you guys watch the Oscars last night at all?
No.
Nice. I was the only one who watched, only a little bit, just because I was waiting for the weather to come on after.
I did see the Cadillac commercial though.
Yeah, so there was a new Cadillac, and it's the CT6 that was teased in their Oscar spot, which is funny because everybody was expecting an Oscar spot that had no Cadillac in it at all, no cars. And then they showed their CT6 driving by with their Dare Greatly campaign. What do you guys think? I mean, Juan has had some pretty cool cars. Like an SOT8, yeah. And you had a CTS-V at one point. Too,
I did. I took both the first and second gen.
I love the CTS-V.
Yeah.
So what do you think then, as a Cadillac fan?
I'm a Cadillac fan.
Well, but, I mean, as a you spent your money on it. Spent somebody's money on it.
Yeah, it's true. Thank you, federal government. It's interesting because, as I understand it, it's going to be a rather large car. And I before the podcast, I was looking at some of the Audi production numbers just to kind of see where they were and where they've gone over the last couple of years. And it's interesting that, and I'm not sure if this is just Cadillac just saying we need a halo vehicle because the XTS wasn't it, clearly. Yeah. So I'm not sure exactly what this CT6 is going to offer that the CTS doesn't. I mean, and what's great about Cadillac is, I read back-to-back press releases. The first one was complimenting the CTS transaction price being higher than the BMW. And I think it was the very next day or the day after, Cadillac came out saying they were reducing the price of the CTS. And so I'm not sure if Cadillac understands exactly what Cadillac is doing in terms of how they're defining success and what market they're going after. And I mean, I know their new boss and their new New York City vibe has, you know, billions of dollars behind them in terms of reconfiguring the brand. And I know there's going to be, I think there's going to be a new convertible soon too, which again, a convertible, a large sedan, neither one of those are volume products. So I'm not sure if they're really going for volume. Maybe they're just going for redefining the brand or daring to be relevant. Was that what the title of the commercial was? Dare to be relevant?
No, only those who dare drive the world.
Oh, well, relevance would be kind of nice too for them, I think. Yeah, small.
Well, I mean, I do. I saw your post about, you know, why the hell is Cadillac not rushing a new SRX to market, given how white hot the luxury crossover market is.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, I have no idea.
There was some recent rumors that they will be showing a new SRX at the New York Auto Show next month.
They could use a new SRX because the current one, while it sells a lot better than the original, is ugly.
It's dated.
I mean, it's been good for them, actually. It was provided the lift they needed when they needed it. But, you know, why is there not a compact SUV below that, too? I mean, that seems to have done surprisingly well for Buick with the Encore. The Encore is probably too small a segment for Cadillac, but there is room in between.
Mm-hmm. The MKC has been great for Lincoln. You know, for all of Lincoln's problems, you know, the MKC is the one thing that helped them grow, 15% last year?
Yeah, and do you think it's the MKC itself, or it's just that market, that, you know, that segment at that price point?
Well, it's that segment, and, you know, within that segment, you know, the MKC is quite a nice choice. I mean, it's a nice vehicle. You know, fuel economy is not spectacular, but it drives really well. I think it looks good. Really nice interior. So I think it's well placed within that segment. You know, against cars like the Q5 and the X3, and the Lexus NX. So, you know, I mean, that, the sales of that, you know, like I said, are the only reason that Lincoln was up overall in 2014.
Well, and that's a product that really hits the market. It hits a wide group of people. Mm-hmm. You've got sort of aging boomers that are looking for something that's easy to get in and out of, is comfortable, has all the luxury, isn't necessarily big because they're downsizing their car because the kids are out of the house. You know, they've been out of the house, that kind of thing. So it hits that market. It hits people who...
Wait, I thought those people were buying Scions. No?
I mean, no.
No one's buying Scions.
Right. Scion is how you say Saab in Japanese.
Ouch.
Let's just hope that when they finally kill Scion, it'll stay dead instead of being a zombie brand.
Yeah, Scion... We don't need to get into Scion right now.
Yeah. So I mean, what do you think does Cadillac need a bigger sedan?
Yeah.
CT6 is the biggest, because that's...
Yeah, it's going to be like the size of the S-Class, right? I mean, I can understand the idea that, because everybody says this, right? Like, oh, you need to make an S-Class size sedan. No. What Cadillac needs to make is money.
Yes.
That's not what's going to make you money. I think it'll
make them some money, because you know the margins on cars like that are going to be, you know, higher than on the smaller cars.
Yeah, but if you could sell, if you can sell bazillions of the Q5 size whatever Cadillac.
Yeah, you know. No, I agree. I'm personally, you know, I am not inclined to ever buy a crossover from any brand, but. You know, the reality is that, you know, that segment is, as you said, white hot. You know, I mean, everybody's doing really well in that segment. And for Cadillac to be missing out on that, you know, I think is a big mistake. They need to get the new SRX and maybe something one size smaller than that to fill that out.
So, I mean, maybe they'll surprise us in New York and we'll see a completely viable SRX that is the right size, is the, you know, that covers the right spread of the market. You know, it, relying on a single vehicle to cover that much real estate is really kind of dangerous. You know, they've got the SRX and then the Escalade. It seems like there's room, because what you really want to do is you want to create a life cycle for your buyer too. So you want to get somebody who's entering the luxury market, and then you want to keep them there so they can move up from, the sort of entry product to the SRX to the Escalade or whatever. Or at the very least, you want to have an offering for people to fit there. We talk about how it's really cynical for some of these luxury automakers to be moving down market like they are, but it's also like that's where the buyers are. So,
yeah, well, your $239 a month lease brings in your new buyers to the brand, and they become affinity purchases, and there you go. You know?
Right.
I mean,
I don't know. We have just solved Cadillac's problem.
Yeah. They need a CUV with a $200 a month lease. Done.
Sounds like a plan. the problem too is like, how many standalone Cadillac stores are there? Are there a lot, or do they wind up going, oh, you want the $200 a month lease with the luxury CUV? That's over at Buick.
Yeah.
Go get it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really – they're in a tough spot. They'll figure it out.
You know, there's more standalone Cadillac stores than there are Lincoln.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
There's not many standalone Lincolns anymore.
No.
No. There used to be Lincoln Mercury, and then they were lonely. We had one in town, and they closed. That's my story. All right, let's do some questions, because that's always the most fun part, because we get to spend people's money. We always get a bunch of questions about what cars people should buy. So we can go there, or we can actually do some like real hardcore questions. What do you guys prefer?
Whatever you pick.
Yeah, you pick, Dan. It's your show.
Let's see. All right. Well, I mean, I'm trying to be
We'll come up with answers to whatever kind of questions. You know, they may not be any good answers, but you know.
Yeah, I mean, answers are answers, right? Okay. Of all the luxury brands rumored to be working on all electric sedans and SUVs, who do you think will be the first to bring one to market?
Didn't Tesla already do that?
They have a sedan.
You mean of the incumbent brands?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, luxury brands like you know, BMW and Audi and Volvo and all of those others.
I think, you know, probably either Audi or BMW. You know, BMW's already got the i3 and the i8. You know, and there's rumors that they're doing an i5 based off the i3 that'll be, you know, a bit bigger. Audi and Volkswagen, you know, have made a pretty strong commitment to electrification recently. So I think I wouldn't be surprised if Audi does something in the near future.
I'll go with the Germans. they're very aggressive about it.
Yeah.
But don't sleep on hydrogen, right? No, wait. No.
That joke went down poorly. All right. Let's do a Cadillac question. Does the CT6 look different enough to not become the next Cadillac STS? Not quite sure. Oh, I see. STS sort of didn't look different enough from the CTS, and it was... But I'm not sure about that question, actually. Does it look different enough to not die an early death, I think is what he's asking.
I think so, but you know, I don't think the styling is going to be what makes or breaks the CTS or the CT6. You know, the name might. You know, this new naming convention. Don't even get me started on that.
Welcome to the global market.
Yeah. You know, I think it's going to come down to other factors, like, you know, how it drives and, you know, what the interior is like. You know, if they can really distinguish it from the CTS there. You know, and offer some unique technology that's not available on the lesser models, then, you know, I think it's got a pretty good shot.
I think its success really depends on what it looks like when it's badged as a Buick in China.
Probably.
You mean the Avenir?
Yeah. Yeah. I can't see this car. I mean, visually, it's an embodiment, I think, of the new logo and everything. So I think visually it looks good from the front end, but the rear three quarter, it looks like an A8 or any other kind of boring, smooth. But at least it's got that non-coupe. It's a true sedan. They didn't turn it into any kind of a BMW GT Grand Touring.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I don't know.
I don't know that. I mean, and maybe it's the Halo car, right? They're making a buzz, they're getting notice, and then very shortly, we're going to have the New York show, and they're going to show stuff. So, you know, they're getting their name out there in the news. Whatever. We'll see. All right. So, since autonomous cars are the topic this week, and we recently posted a story about Sony buying the movie rights for a comedy about autonomous cars. So how do you think that's going to go? Is it going to be like, you know, Short Circuit or The Great Race? Or, you know, will it be about cars with personalities like Knight Rider? That's a very esoteric question. Knight Rider, by the way, that car, Knight Rider, Kit was insufferable.
Coming from Sony, it could be anything.
It's going to be bad. A movie about autonomous cars. They had one. It was called Herbie. It was terrible. They remade it. It was even worse.
And then there was Cars.
Yeah. Cars was good, though.
Yeah, Cars.
I liked Cars.
Yeah. And Planes and Fire Rescue. And
yeah, Planes was not as good. Cars was... Car, yeah. I'm an expert in all those movies.
See, that's what I envision.
You still have little kids.
Yeah.
I have little kids too. But when I think autonomous cars, I mean, I would love for Lightning McQueen to be a car that has a personality. So it becomes a friend, but I don't think we're there yet. I don't think I'm going to bond with my car. No, they don't tell good jokes. They don't.
Yeah, I don't know. I have a car that's a pretty good joke.
Yeah.
I think it's. I mean, I don't. I have a real.
Do they know who's? Do they? Yeah. Yeah. So.
It's going to suck. You're probably going to be better off just watching it on Netflix. So there you go.
Or watching something else.
All right, yeah. Let's spend somebody else's money. Got such a variety of questions here. Let's see. Josh in Texas. He wants to get a fun second car. He's got a 2007 GTI right now. Trying to decide between a 2014 C7 Corvette Z51, 2014 Cayman, or 2011 Cayman S. Which would we pick and why?
I mean, if you're gonna get, if you're gonna go used, you know, might as well go for the 11 Cayman. You know, it's probably, you know, you're probably gonna save a lot of money up front, you know, that you can put into parts later on, and it's probably not gonna drive all that different from the newer Cayman.
Yeah, I like the Cayman and I like the S better, but I mean, Corvette.
Yeah, I have to go Corvette because once. Well, so I had an 08 GTI, and I've had a couple of C6s. And I don't know why he's looking at a 2014 C6. I would pick up a super high mileage 2009 DLS3, pick it up for like 20 grand. I mean, there's not much wrong on those cars. Yeah, just no. I mean, there was no Grand Sport back then, but –
yeah, 2009 was the first year of the Grand Sport.
Did they have the Grand Sport? Oh, I thought it was like 11. But no, I would get a Z51 base car, 2009, cyber gray, personal preference. And because, I mean, I had one with 100,000 miles on it at one point, and I never had one single thing go wrong. So, I mean, I don't know what the Porsche reliability is like. Never been a Porsche guy. Maybe you guys know better, but...
I've never owned one.
And any expensive European car, you know, is going to have its foibles.
Yeah.
I mean,
in terms
of raw reliability, you're probably better off with the Corvette. You know, anything with a, you know, with a, an American V8 in it is probably going to be more reliable and certainly going to be a lot cheaper to fix in the long term.
Right. What's the sort of, let me see if I can insult it well enough. It's got the body of a boat with the engine of a truck, right? That's Pushrod V8 with a fiberglass body. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't think I did real well insulting it, but I really like the Corvette.
Hey, you know, it's a damn fast boat, and, you know,
yeah,
trucks can go pretty quick these days, too.
I do quite like the Cayman and Boxster, though. I think those are really those cars are really well done, and they're built very well. I don't know in terms of reliability and stuff like that. But if you're looking for a second fun car, I don't know that that's really what you care about. So it depends on what you want. The Cayman, I feel like, would be really disappointing without being in the S. And the S, remember, the Cayman S has about, I don't know, 210 horsepower. So it's not exactly a Corvette in that sense. It's a different car.
If you think about it, you know, if it's going to be a track day car, then, you know, yeah, maybe go for the Corvette or the newer Porsche. But if it's something you're going to drive on the street, you know, driving a slow car fast can be a lot more fun than driving a fast car slow.
Yeah, well, and the Cayman and Boxster are really good to drive, like, in pretty much any condition. Or any weather conditions, I should say. Not like any – don't buy a clap that one. But they – they're a different car, you know. They have limited power compared to, like, the effortless torque of the Corvette. So it depends on what you want. They're a lot more precise in terms of handling.
And visually, they send two different messages, too. I mean, you know, stereotypes be what they are. There's a big difference from a guy who drives a Cayman S versus a guy who drives a Corvette. I mean, and if he's coming from a GTI, I'm presuming he's already looking at the Germans anyways, so...
Yeah.
Go get your Porsche.
Yeah, have fun with that. All right, so another car buying question. Alex in Indiana says he's in snowy northern Indiana, so he's thinking of a snow weather car. He recently has become very interested in wagons, so his instant thought is a 2005 Volvo V50 T5 all-wheel drive with a 6-speed manual. Do you have any other suggestions? Yeah, I suggest you do not get that car. That's the first year.
There, Mr.
Yeah, Wolf. That's the first year of the the C1 V50 and S40, I believe. It was either 2004 or 2005. Shunk had one of those, and it was a nightmare. He had an S40. It was an electrical nightmare. Like, the door module was not working and stuff. Like, they're okay to drive, but, you know, if that's the car you want, you can wind up with a Mazda 3, because that's on the C1 platform as well. It's probably going to be a lot cheaper. No all-wheel drive, but...
yeah, but you know what? Throw a set of snow tires on there instead.
Yeah. I mean, a snow weather car means something that you like, but you don't expect it to stick around for too long. I mean, could have a lot of fun with a WRX, and I know that that's against sort of my policy of recommending Subarus, but
no, I mean, I like the Mazda 3 suggestion. You know, buy an extra set of wheels and snow tires, swap them as the weather conditions require, and you're good to go.
Yeah. Or an Audi. Get an Audi.
All road.
Yeah. I mean, if you're going to go Volvo, you might as well go whole hog, right?
Yeah.
Just deal with the Audi. Get yourself like one of those, one of the early 2000s.
So if you're going to suffer the pain of, you know, cars
look good
that,
doing
may,
it.
That may or may not run,
right.
Yeah, go all the way.
Yeah. I mean, get yourself a car that, like, to repair something simple, you need to remove the entire nose. I mean, come on, have some. That's a car with gravitas. It says, "I give no crap," because it's going to cost me bazillions to fix. And I don't care because I like it, and they drive nice. Audis drive.
They do.
Nice.
I will give Audis and Volkswagens that they do drive very well when they drive. Yeah.
So we've spent a bunch of your money on terrible suggestions, and we've talked about a bunch of policy, and we've spent an hour and a half doing it. So I think we should wrap up this podcast and let you guys get back to your normal lives. So Sam Abu-Samid and Juan Barnett, I want to thank you guys for coming on to episode 419 of the Autoblog podcast. I had a good time. We could do this for another few hours, I think. But we'll just have you back again for another time.
Sounds great.
Thanks, Dan.
So we'll catch you guys next week. Thanks. You can subscribe to the Autoblog podcast in iTunes, send us an email at podcast@autoblog.com, or find us on Twitter @AutoblogPodcast. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.